Good evening and welcome to Screen Tone Club, episode 61, recording on the 3rd of October 2020 for release on the 13th of October 2020, because we've gotten slightly out of kink with the whole dates and times and, oh god, lockdown is making fools of us all. My name is Elwes, this is Elliot Page, and I'm joined by my ever sensible, ever together co-host, Mr. Andy Hanley. How you doing, Andy?
I mean, you say together. I feel like you flatter me. But yes, I am here. I am present.
Well, frankly, that's all we can expect of any of us right now. Let's face it. This is your fortnightly look at manga with a focus on joint discussion. If you like what we're doing here, please consider maybe supporting us on Patreon. Patreon is how, frankly, we get supported and pays for the manga we read for this podcast, also light novels. If you support us, you can support us from as little as $1, and every single dollar is a massive boost to us, our silly egos. And if you join us from $3 a month, you get to vote on what we cover in our monthly patron-only bonus episodes. We just finished up recording an episode on Ascendance of a Bookworm, which will have been out for at least a week by the time you're listening to this. But hey, you can listen to us talk about a light novel, which has been hotly requested by our fans. Also, as always, shout-outs to Mr. Rob Jessup, who supports us at the $12 shout-out tier on the Patreon. So once again, thank you very much, Rob. So moving on to the main bulk of this episode, first and foremost, we've got Returning Champions, where we discuss series that we have talked about before on this show. And so this is kind of a big one, I feel, both in terms of like, oh damn, it's over, but also kind of in how large it's loomed, at least personally. Maybe you're going for this as well, Andy, but I finished up all of Silver Spoon. Silver Spoon by Hiromu Arakawa. I've probably mispronounced that. My apologies. Who is the author of Fullmetal Alchemist. And in fact, today is Fullmetal Alchemist Day because it's the 3rd of October. So cool. That's a nice bit of serendipity there. Big fan of this series, especially since the anime came out and Andy had a hand in releasing that. So conflict of interest there, but whatever. So Silver Spoon finished up just this month. The final volume, volume 15, came out. And that tied up the whole thing with a bow, which is kind of bizarre because Silver Spoon in general has been ending since volume 11. Like, it's kind of been in the final arc and the, like, very clearly signposted and gradiated ending sequence ever since then, which, you know, is far better than suddenly being cancelled and having to wrap things up in two volumes. Oh, God. It ends kind of in this rather strange, bittersweet way, because it spends quite a lot of time wrapping things up. It takes care of, like, what's going to happen to Kobama and his family? What's going to happen to the Mikage Ranch? Is Aki Makage going to get into the school she wants to, thus bucking the trend of inheriting her family's farm? Will Hachiken ever figure out what the hell he wants to do? Will he ever get over his dad? Will his brother not be a useless waste of space? Maybe. What about all the side characters who you've come to love over these 15 volumes but feel like you've been with for much, much longer? I mean, you've been with them for a subjective 3 years of manga in terms of their school life. Will the right people kiss, and will the right people make up, and will the right moves happen? And it ends in a positive way. Like, it does right by its characters. It's not like happy endings across the board. Quite a few characters who initially you think would be sorted definitely aren't sorted, and they're having to scramble in reality. It's also a manga that is kind of touched by reality, because a lot of its sort of ending and some of its overriding sort of themes, as the series was written, things kind of shifted underneath the series and political and farming realities changed. And this mostly comes into effect in the final volume and also in the final afterword, where it basically says, hey, I had a completely different ending scoped out, but the territory I was going to highlight got engulfed by war, and so I had to scrap that and make a whole new ending. So shows how Arakawa sensei can kind of tilt things very quickly. And I really enjoyed it. Like, it's a really great read. The last two volumes were kind of this strange mixture of emotion for me about being sad to see the characters go, but being really happy to see the culmination of their efforts. And there was plenty of good jokes along the way, like some nice gags, lots of dumb comedy. The final chapter is a bit of a humdinger at 70 pages and, like, does a whole time skip thing. The one thing I will say is that the main sort of romance between Mikage and Hachiken, who have been dancing around each other the whole time, basically as soon as there's a sort of resolution to it, it vanishes, which is very strange, at least to myself, where it's a case of like, oh, finally, they asked each other out, thank fuck, and then it stops. It's like, oh, okay, you're done with that plot point. Anything more about this? No? Okay, fine. Let's have an ending then. And even like Mikage herself comments in the like bonus Omake chat pages that, oh, he finally does something romantic in the fucking end of the manga, but after the actual end, like, you know, in the volume only bonus joke content, which is a bit of a strange meta thing, but hey, at that point, the series is over, so you can kind of do what you like. But yeah, I greatly, greatly enjoyed it. It's a great romp from start to finish. I mentioned it on Twitter and someone like said, oh, I want season 3 of the anime. And it's like, well, so would I. I don't think it's going to happen, but you know, stranger things have happened, frankly. But yeah, it was a really good read. I really enjoyed it. Also like, because it's Yen Press and it's on Kobo, it's like £4.50 a volume, which makes it extremely reasonably priced, especially for something that is so well drawn, well researched and heartfelt and very, more than anything, interesting to read. Like, I don't know bullshit about farming. So really fun to read and really enjoyable. Love the characters. And yeah, it was a great time. So recommended highly. I don't know how far you or where you are on this, Andy, but I know I've poked you about it more than once before now.
Yeah, I've not actually read beyond the first volume that we covered on this podcast, but it's very much on my list of things that I want to read, because yeah, I'm very much on the side of like, yeah, I would have liked to have seen a third season of the anime, but that seems unlikely at this point, and I really need to see what happens to those characters post season 2, so I will definitely be reading through this at some point in time to find out.
Yeah, I must admit, it's one of these things where digital availability and high speed internet made it almost like weird, a really funny like way to read it, not in a bad way, but more the fact that like I was having a, I've been reading this in spurts, frankly, and like at one point I went from like volume 10 to volume 13 in one day, mostly because I was having a garbage day, and like I'd finish a volume, then the link to buy the next one would pop up and I'd go, yeah, you know what, whatever, and boop, and then I've paid £4.50 and bought another volume, it downloaded in a minute and I was reading it immediately. So that kind of binge reading is a lot easier in the digital age, because you don't have to go back to the bloody bookstore. So yeah, really, really easy just to kind of like just consume the whole thing whole cloth, which, good for me, bad for my bank balance, but you know, it's not Full Metal Alchemist length, so it's not quite as terrifying as all that. But yeah, it made it a really fun read, just kind of binge, especially like in some of the earlier volumes when it's kind of barreling through Hachiken, like getting used to farm life and basically getting like whacked around the head by everything. And you know, like I say, there's a lot of drawbacks and a lot of like human growth in this. Like at one point, Hachiken basically like nukes something really badly, but what, you know, him even being there was a miracle to begin with, so you kind of can't get too angry at him. So yeah, I really enjoyed it, really, really enjoyed it. And yeah, the ending makes the ending sort of a Make explaining how the ending changed is really wild, and kind of a fascinating meta element to it of like, oh god, you had to rewrite the whole thing, shit. Yeah, so yeah, really good fun,
kind of crazy.
Yeah, but if anything, I think it works really well with the ending. In fact, perhaps maybe even better. Who knows? I would not be privy to the full extent of what the original ending would have been. But yeah, I really, really, really enjoyed it. Three reallys, count them. So yeah, that's Silver Spoon. And yeah, as I say, like the anime is great. Recommended it highly. Manga also great. You know, the art style is translated well between the two. And so yeah, really, really recommended it. That's another two reallys. That's five reallys. You should now understand how much I mean it. So yeah, that's been Silver Spoon, returning champion. Unless you have anything else to mention, Andy?
No, nothing on my end.
Cool. I've already gabbed for way too much already, so do you want to take the first pick, if you don't mind?
Yeah, sure thing. Yeah, so my only pick for this episode is Burn the Witch, which is it's merely a few chapters long, which is probably for the best, as it is the latest work from Tite Kubo of Bleach fame, and given how much it sounded like he burned himself out on Bleach, probably just limiting it to a few chapters for now at least is not a bad idea at all.
Yeah, because it's like a it was like a one shot initially, and now it's a four chapter like mini series almost. The whole thing works out to like just over a volume in length, so it kind of fits for us anyway.
Yes, yeah, it was kind of like pretty much perfect size wise, and yeah, like it was also a one shot that was very clearly not meant to just be a one shot, because it drops enough things in there of just like, yeah, I'm going to make more of this. An anime adaptation has literally just come out as of, I think, yesterday at the time of recording that, yeah, I've not watched.
But it's like a movie split into three 30-minute episodes, I believe.
Basically, yeah. So they're kind of going all in on it, as you might expect from the creator of Bleach. But anyway, Burn the Witch is set in London, its main character is a girl called Nol Nihashi, who is not Japanese, as she's keen to point out throughout the series. And for all of 2 seconds, it seems like she's just a normal schoolgirl. But actually, she is a member of an organization called Wingbind. Which actually protects people from dragons, because underneath London there is an entire other kind of secret society, effectively, innovatively called Reverse London, which is kind of a place of magic and witches, effectively, as per the title. And there's a whole load of magic and dragons and all of that kind of stuff going on that is mostly centered around Reverse London, but of course, as with all these things, it occasionally escapes out into actual normal London, and these things kind of need to be cleaned up in short order. Noel kind of works as kind of a dynamic duo, if you like, with another girl whose name I've completely just forgotten.
Ninny Spankole.
There you go.
I love her dearly.
Yeah. They make up kind of a really good sort of a really good duo. But unfortunately for Noel, she's also kind of somewhat burdened by a childhood friend called Balgo, who is A, infatuated with her, and B, a complete moron, who is kind of constantly trying to foist himself upon her, romantically or otherwise, and she just kind of has to rather tiresomely kind of push him to arm's length. But as it turns out, Balgo kind of becomes a key pivotal part of this series.
Sadly.
Yes, indeed, sadly. Because the whole kind of like original one-shot chapter is about kind of a mutual friend of Noel and Balgo, who basically it turns there's a big plot twist there that he is not all that he seems, and Noel and Ninny have to kind of clean up the mess. But in the resulting kind of occurrences there, Balgo becomes what is known as a dragon clad, and he is somebody who has kind of come into contact with a dragon, which is basically the setup for everything that follows, because that's a rather unique power, and in his particular instance, it basically kind of leads to him being tagged for extermination, because it is seen as a problem in Reverse London. And there's a whole bunch of kind of machinations around that, within the kind of the main sort of bulk of the 4 chapters, as Balgo kind of is A, put under the protection of Noel and Ninny, and then kind of becomes this target, basically, for the kind of the powers that be. And it sort of waxes and wanes throughout before dropping a big old kind of, again, clearly there's going to be more Burn the Witch at some point, because it introduces a whole bunch of characters and sets things up for what could be a much longer running series.
Yeah, it so every last part of it, ever since like halfway through the first chapter, is basically everything that I find extremely frustrating about Kubo Teet as an author, in particularly with the writing, because like there is an idea here, like there, like Noel and Ninny as a double act are hilarious. I love Ninny. I think she's great. She's a complete nut, and she has explosion friggin' like Bakugo hair, and she is really abrasive but really caring. I really love that hot blooded character archetype. Noel is, you know, I don't know, the one thing that's hilarious about Noel and I could not stop laughing at is how her bust went from like respect a boy in chapter in the one shot chapter to, oh, look at these globes in chapters 2 through 5, you know, the 4 chapter extended mini series. But this series, this little sort of series, small series, as small as it is, like commits all these sins that I would like to think that Kubo would at least learn from Bleach, in terms of, okay, we've got a good premise here. Now let's overburden it with all this bureaucracy and tons of unstoppable characters. Okay. And now let's completely burn past any of the initial low level threats into like apocalyptic level stuff immediately, skipping over any material that might be interesting in the in between. Like, it's really extremely frustrating to me that it skips past what is an interesting premise over into like built up layers of premise that are nowhere near as interesting and are going to have 4,000 characters I'm not going to care about. And it'll have cool eye candy and cool fashion and cool stuff happening, but I won't remember any of it because I won't be able to keep any of it in my head. And it will burn through characters and premises and ideas at a rate of knots until I'm fed up and don't read it anymore, much like Bleach. And I could just see it happening. And even from the first chapter, where the first chapter ends, as you say, with Balgo becoming plot critical and becoming like a load-bearing MacGuffin human, along with his like cute dog, who is also a load-bearing plot MacGuffin from even earlier, like... sucks. Like, Balgo sucks. He's a garbage character. I hate him. I hate him as a character. I hate him as a plot element. And I think he, like, I don't know, he kind of exudes this, like, stench around him that, although he is only one part of why I didn't like this series in the end, he's kind of the first sign of, oh, I don't think people have learned enough about how they should be handling material, which is, again, very frustrating when you have an interesting world and you have, you know, Ninny and Noel, who are much put upon. And, you know, there's almost like a 5-page spread in this where it lays bare the economy of reverse London and the problems of the characters. And I was thinking to myself, I thought, huh, this would be awesome. This almost sounds like Cowboy Bebop, but with witches and dragons and reverse London. And no, it skips straight past that into magical, fantastical realms, 6 divine beasts, blah, 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 blah. And I could not care less. And so, while this is very pretty to look at, I mean, once again, the old joke that Kubo Teach should do band posters and like single shot illustrations and fashion catalogs still stands. But as a writer, fucking stop. Like, someone stop him, for the love of God. Especially given that at the end of the, like, mild spoilers, but at the end of this first chapter, at the first one shot, it reveals that Wingbind in Reverse London are part of Soul Society West Division. And I basically almost threw my tablet across the room because fuck off. Like, fuck you. You don't go back to the well. What are you doing? And I'm just rambling now, but it sucks. It sucks because I want to like this. I love Ninny. I love Noel. I like the characters. Like, the fact that dragons quickly are explained as being not just an actual fucking dragon, like a worm, they're actually like Flintstones. Like you get different dragons that do different stuff. Like, one of them is for meat, one of them is like a crystal lizard from Dark Souls who grows rocks on his back, and you get other ones which are like Flintstone stuff. I mean, hell, even the brooms they ride are little dragons, and you have to be a witch or a wizard to use them, because otherwise touching a dragon fucks you right up, which is why obviously Balgo is a special case, because he touched a dragon and didn't explode. And so that's the stuff it's interesting world and all this eye candy, but man, it misuses every last element of it. And I'm so annoyed. And yeah, sorry, Andy, I've rambled completely off the hinge. Maybe you don't feel as strongly as I do, but holy cow, it feels good to get that off my chest.
No, I mean, actually, like, I actually really enjoyed this, to be honest. I definitely.
Which?
I definitely share kind of your ultimate concerns. Like, I feel like if this gets spun out into a long-running thing, I think it will absolutely run into all the same problems that Bleach had. Like, I mean, as you've mentioned, it's dropped, you know, hints, and I believe the anime adaptation has also, you know, been very teasing about, like, yeah, this is kind of set in the same universe as Bleach, which, yeah, like you say, that's not a great idea.
But the whole Burn the Witch, at the end of the first chapter, and also the anime does this, where Burn the Witch, if you colour certain parts of the letters, it says Bleach, which,
yeah,
I actually ended up clapping at that, because I was like, ah, Kubo, fuck you. Like, but even in this first, like, little four-part, like, mini-series, I say, all the problems of Bleach came back. Too many characters, skipping over plot elements, setting up this huge world-ending stuff that is boring. It's the exact same stuff again. Like, I can't stand it.
Yeah, I mean, I find, like, I feel like in a limited dose, like, I didn't have an issue with any of that. Like, I mean, I think Noel and Ninny do a lot of heavy lifting in terms of kind of making that stuff work.
Yep.
I'm always, like, a sucker for the whole, like, kind of, like, secret society, like, within a society thing. Like, I mean, much as it is now maligned, thanks to its author, like, Harry Potter does that really well. Like, I think this has a really fun, interesting take on that. Like you say, the whole kind of Flintstones angle with dragons is really cool. Like, I'm definitely, like, that stuff is always catnip to me. There's something about that kind of stylistically that I really enjoy, and it looks particularly good here, because, like, this series does look tremendous, like, all the way through.
Oh, totally.
And yeah, like, I think it just, For me, it just kind of got away with it simply because it's, you know, a few self-contained chapters and all the kind of big and world-ending stuff. It kind of felt like it was all sufficiently around the periphery of it that it was kind of easy not to worry about that and just kind of focus on like, ah, this just looks kind of cool. And I kind of like enjoy the action quotient of it. And especially once it gets past that kind of initial one-shot chapter, it kind of... Balgo is still incredibly annoying, but he's kind of pushed to the background enough. Like he might as well be a vase or something. Like, you know, he's just this kind of precious thing that shouldn't be broken. And it's like, you know, he might as well be an inanimate object because he doesn't really actually have a whole lot to do as an actual character, which is probably like the best thing you could possibly do with him. Like I would still rather anything, any other kind of character type be shoved into that position, but it's at least at the point where I'm like, well, you know, he's just kind of there, and it's just kind of like he's almost a MacGuffin in himself that just everything else revolves around rather than a character. And I think that was just enough to kind of let me just soak in kind of the visual side of it and just the general kind of broad strokes of just like, I don't know, this is just a kind of cool thing just to see play out.
Yeah, the visuals are great. Like the costumes are great, the characters are great, the action is great, there's some really good paneling work, there's some really fun, you know, there's some good fun with it, but I really can't forgive Balgo, which sounds a bit much, but it is the case where it's like he's like the garbage version of Jujutsu Kaisen. You know, he eats something he shouldn't and now he's plot critical, whereas in Jujutsu Kaisen they use that, whereas Balgo is a useless fuck who says knickers all the time because England. But yeah, it's just the fact that he still hangs around and dictates, and the characters themselves like oscillate wildly on his use or worth, and you know, as you say, he gets pushed away, but it is this element of like, okay, he's now a load-bearing plot element, but he's still fucking useless. But yeah, if just give me a dog, okay? Like the dog with dragon wings is pretty all right, so just keep that one around.
Yeah, well, I mean, ironically, that would probably actually have worked better had the dog like accidentally become dragon clad and like been. I mean, obviously,
well,
I guess
he is in a way.
I mean, yeah, there is a whole thing there, but like, had they just had like some other kind of pet do that, like again, clearly, there's, you know, you can tell that there is far more kind of already in Kubo's head of this story than what you see on these pages. And I mean, I think that kind of original one-shot chapter shows that clearly Kubo wants to try and give like Balgo kind of redeeming arcs and redeeming stories, because like he has that kind of moment in that prologue chapter that is clearly, you know, trying to get you back on side with him. But yeah, it is frustrating, like, because especially because he stands out in a series where all the other characters are kind of either cool or innately likable. Like, you know, even kind of the quote-unquote bad guys in these chapters are kind of cool and kind of have something to them. Like, even the other characters that have kind of put about as being kind of useless have something going on and something going for them. And Balgo just really kind of sticks out like a sore thumb as just not really fitting into any of the other characters around him. Because, I mean, you know, even though this is a pretty kind of, you know, short and sort of action-oriented few chapters, like, you know, Noel and Ninny's characters actually get a bit of sort of development, and you kind of get to see a bit more about them and their relationship to one another and other characters. Like, Balgo doesn't even really get any of that. He's just kind of there to just be annoying.
Yeah, I mean, like,
the
time to start the rehabilitation is in the four-chapter mini-series, but again, admittedly, the storyline he gets skipped over for, especially with Ninny and her sort of past, or her main life, quote unquote, in real London, is interesting. That's really cool. But at the same time, you kind of have Balgo hanging around like a bad smell, because he is an unresolved plot element or an unresolved character arc where, you know, you expect him and he seems like he is going to redeem himself or be redeemed somehow. Meanwhile, this more interesting plot is like with Ella is like nipping in the corner. And it's really bizarre in that regard, because it's like, oh, there's an interesting storyline here, but it's also getting pushed out by this other grander storyline and this unresolved. Again, it's one of the reasons why I so, you know, react so weirdly, is the fact of like, oh, you know, is this all unresolved and is just skipping past stuff that is interesting material? And so don't trust Kubo at all. So it's, but yeah, it, at the same time, it definitely keeps up the pace, and it is a feast for the eyes. So it's pleasant in that regard. Yeah, it's just the frustration about like all this cool stuff that is being passed over again. So yeah, kind of, and you know, you got the cool old man boss of Nolan Ninny, who is clearly up to some shit, and you know, he's got his own bag of tricks. Reminds me of like the janitor from Control, if you remember that video game, except not quite as much finish.
Yeah, I'm playing that video game currently, so yeah, I'm with you. But yeah, I mean, those moments do feel really, really weird, because yeah, like had those things not been in there and this was completely self-contained, you know, I feel like it would have kind of ramped up my enjoyment another level of just, hey, like here's the thing. You enjoyed the thing is done. But yeah, like it's clearly doing a lot of legwork and background work to make this into a bigger, more sprawling thing. And I certainly share your reservations on that count, at least, that I'm not sure I'm ready for that.
Well, I mean, even not to be, I know I'm being mean, but like to put the boot in, I mean, not even Bleach. I mean, Bleach didn't finish out the anime, did it? I mean, the anime got cancelled before the manga finished. Yeah. Because it dragged out so much, like it could not help itself. Anyway, at the same time, really cool character designs. Like it had all of Kilbo's strengths are here. It's just a shame they're also here with the weaknesses. But yeah, like the fashion, the characters, like Ninny basically saves it. Like I was kind of ready to stop it, to put it down more than once, but it's like, okay, no, Ninny is taking full front and center stage. So let's see what she does, because I like her an awful lot. So
yeah, and I think her and Noel kind of like there's a good character dynamic there, in that they're both very different characters, but there's also like you can kind of see why that dynamic sort of works on a different level of like, you know, they're kind of chalk and cheese, but they sort of get on okay, they kind of work as a pair of colleagues okay, and it's kind of it's hard not to just want to, I mean, in a way, like what I'd really like out of this is again, yeah, as we've been saying, not the grandiose stuff, but I'd love just a fully kind of episodic, just like Dragon of the Week kind of deal with those two characters, because I think they could carry that quite readily.
Yeah, totally. I mean, they work really well, because like you say, they're chalk and cheese, but also they're trusting each other with their lives, because they're doing dangerous stuff. And, you know, Ninny wants to get promoted into the, like, all singing, all dancing combat brigade, whilst Noel's a complete enigma, because she's been fascinating, but not had any real sort of, like, hints as to what's going on in her rather, like, strange little closed off head. But yeah, like, I'd love to see, like, you know, the episode or the chapter where there's no dragons going amok. So they're just hanging about and they're like, well, we're on call. We're on dragon call, but there's nothing to do. So I don't know. Let's just hang about for a bit. That'd be cool. That's kind of catnip to me, but no, I doubt that's going to happen. But if I'm proven wrong, great. I'd love it. So yeah.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see kind of like how this develops, and whether this does turn into just, you know, a big weekly series, or whether kind of, especially given his experiences with Bleach, like Kubo will go at this as in a similar vein of just, you know, having an arc at a time, effectively, of just like, you know, a few chapters, take a break, a few chapters.
I did quite enjoy sorry, Andy.
Because clearly there is going to be more of this.
Totally.
I don't think we can kind of hide that fact.
No, the one thing I did enjoy was the longer chapters, like the less and longer chapters. Because, you know, if you're having to make something interesting every 20 pages every week, that's exhausting to even think about, let alone do. And you wonder how any mangaka does it. But in the case of this, I did enjoy the longer chapters as part of both the one shot and the short series, because it meant there was more time to bed in and get your teeth around all that stuff. So I think that worked really well for what was on show. So yeah, I mean, yeah. And also, like, until recently, I don't know if they stopped it, but it was all available for free for anyone to read in the Shonen Jump app, rather than being in the vault. So that's kind of cool. I don't know if they've put that back away again or not.
Yeah, that was definitely a limited time thing. So yeah, I'm not sure at the time this is going out whether that will still be the case. But I mean, again, this is a good kind of argument for the, you know, pay a couple of quid for Shonen Jump, because, you know, things like this. Again, like if you're a Bleach fan particularly, like you should absolutely check this out, because as mentioned, you know, I suspect if you're somehow still a Bleach fan at the end of all that, you'll probably be way more invested in the fact that this is kind of part of the same universe, etc., etc. But it does all of the things that Kubo does for better and for worse. So if you're into that artist's work, then yeah, this will serve you admirably, I suspect.
Yep, and if you're into that artist's writing, maybe see a specialist. I don't know. No, that's mean. I don't mean that, you know. But no, it's definitely, as you say, warts and all. But I will admit, it's nice having Kubo making something, because he has this flair. Like, if nothing else, that dude can do title pages and characters real well. It's just when there's 400,000 of them all being plot relevant.
Yeah. I mean, that's the thing. I would almost love to be able to shift into some alternate world that had this exact story, but with like somebody less talented in terms of their artwork, because this was definitely a series where I was getting carried along by the visuals, like especially when you kind of get into the sort of later, more action oriented chapters of it. Like, I was just turning the pages just to be kind of like blown away by how cool everything looked. And, you know, there's a real sort of feeling of sort of weight and motion.
Kineticism is the word I use.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. There's a real kinetic energy to kind of all of those panels, and it's just that kind of just keeps you pushing on regardless of you know, your feelings about anything else, or at least it did for me.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. Like, it even with all my grumbling, all my moaning, I was not bored for a second. So that's worth something for sure. So there's that. Yeah. But yeah, do you have anything else to mention about Burn the Witch?
No, I think that is it.
Cool. Bleach 2, Burn the Witch, Electric Boogaloo. But yeah, that's, as I say, available in Shonen Jump, and also available now as like a 3-part movie style chopped up anime thing. Maybe I might watch that just because I'm curious, frankly. Any good reason to jump back into Crunchyroll, I suppose. So, moving on to my pick, even though I've probably spoken enough already. But my pick is something also limited, but not quite as limited. My pick was volume one of The Golden Sheep, which is a 3-volume short series by Kaori Ozaki, who previously did the series, or the one-shot, The God's Lie, which we covered on this here show. And published by Vertical, it's currently complete, as I say, 3 volumes. You can buy it from most good digital bookstores. I don't know if it's available physically. It probably is. Going to get in trouble for assuming, but I got it on sale and I had all 3 volumes, but I restrained myself to this first volume, even though at one point I nearly gave in over this weekend. But The Golden Sheep, so this is going to sound rather base and rather reductive, so apologies in advance, but if you liked The God's Lie, and if you've read The God's Lie, it has some of the same sort of feeling as The God's Lie, quite honestly. Like, it is definitely in the same vein of this author's work, for all positive reasons, I honestly mean. The Golden Sheep is about character Sugu, whose dad is, quote, with the stars now, whatever that means. And so she's going back to where she grew up, the town where she grew up, where she meets up with her old friends, the 4 of them who used to be inseparable. In the meantime, she had moved away in primary school, elementary school, to live in Osaka. And now she's come back with her family, due to family reasons, etc. And they're living in a rather small house with a whole heap of girls. And so she meets up with her old friends, Sora, Yushin, and Asari, and she's all initially quite excited about the whole thing. Like, she's kept all the gifts, the goodbye gifts they gave her, and all this really impactful sort of stuff. And she kind of goes, "Oh, it's great. We've all picked up, like, nothing changed." And reader, stuff has changed. Like, there's no getting away from that. And so what follows is the slow realization for both yourself as the reader, and with, you know, dramatic irony for Sugu, that stuff has in fact changed. Her friends have changed, circumstances have changed, people have changed, and things have gone a bit weird. And much like The God's Lie, The Golden Sheep does an amazing job of, like, just dragging you into this character hell of, like, emotion and turmoil without being, like, you know, hilarious, without being stupid, but also, like, lighthearted and very lovelorn and very sort of emotionally impactful. Like, you know, I would like, so imagine you have a small cousin who is like 7 or 8 and they're pounding you on the chest for some reason. I don't know. Maybe they want to play Minecraft and you've got this little sort of thud, thud, thud on your chest constantly. That is the like emotional feeling of reading this, at least on myself. It's just this. It's never trying to smack you around the head and go, oh, isn't this awful? Oh. It's more just a case of like, yep, here is another thing about life, and here is another thing about life, and here is something else about life, and you're kind of going to have to deal with all this. It also starts in medias res on like, so content warning. I should have said this from the start. Apologies. Content warning for a suicide attempt on like page 3. So it starts in medias res and it gives you that as the like first taste of what's happening. So kind of lets you in from the get-go about something being a bit off. But so yeah, it kind of follows a bunch of other sort of elements from The God's Lie. Quite early on in this volume, Sugu and Sora, for reasons due to their state, run away to Tokyo, which honestly gave me shades of Weathering With You, which was kind of spooky. But it kind of goes from there as all the characters kind of try and untangle their sort of weird relationship, intertwining, and what's happened to them in intervening sort of elements, and being forced to reckon with their changes and how life has adjusted, and also having Sugu come back into their lives and basically be a giant mirror on everything. So yeah, it's really kind of intense and really fascinated to read more of it, just due to the really powerful setup of this and just how meaty it is to get your teeth into and really emotionally sort of just thick. Like, there's a lot here to get your teeth into and chew on, and really loved it. Great characters, great art, really, really loved it. But yeah, it has this cadence of just thudding dread and just emotional, like, just turmoil, just slowly just sort of smacking you over and over again, basically with almost every page. So yeah, maybe I'm waxing a bit lyrical here. So Andy, I'll hand over to you to be a bit more sensible, I suppose.
Well, I've got bad news for you.
Oh no!
No, I love this as well.
Good.
Like, this has been this has been another series that, yeah, like I've been sitting on my hands waiting to record this because I really want to read the remaining volumes to see kind of how things shake out.
Volume covers look a lot nicer, at least.
Well, that's great news. This is definitely just really kind of compelling stuff. I mean, you know,
that's the right word. I definitely agree with you there.
It starts out in kind of like a dark but very kind of interesting place where, you know, it gets you right on the hook for like, what the hell is going on here? And like, it's kind of weird because I feel like other series would start out that way and kind of like wreck itself effectively by giving you too much too soon, but actually like it does a really good job of then kind of like pulling back to show, you know, what's going on and why. And yeah, like it's just good on so many levels. Like the characters from the get-go are all excellent. And the way kind of the veil gets pulled back on those characters is really superbly done. Like, you know, obviously, you've seen, like, right from the outset, as mentioned, you know, there's a suicide attempt. So it's not really a surprise when you see that character kind of being a bit skittish around others the first time you meet them. And, you know, you're there kind of trying to figure out, like, what's going on? Like, what's bothering them? You know, what is the issue there?
Yeah, what is broken, you know, here?
Yeah, and seeing the blocks of that story being kind of built up and, you know, as you kind of come to this kind of slow dawning realization that these prior friendships from, you know, years previously are not just fractured, but utterly broken, and that everybody kind of has sort of been pulled back together by Siggy's return in this way that is actually below the surface, like intensely uncomfortable for everybody because they all have their issues and hang-ups, is like, you know, it's again, really compelling stuff. And there's also, I think, just this very relatable sense to it all as well. Like, I think anybody, even if you've not kind of moved away from, like, you know, where you grew up, like there's still this very relatable feeling of just like, you know, you make these friend groups, especially when you're young and when you're a kid, and then as you go on and grow up, like everybody tends to shift in different directions. Like the people that you once knew become very different people when they hit their teens and then into their 20s. And you sometimes have these shocking realizations of people that you hung out with and you know, you thought of as kind of good people, and that, you know, you'd always be kind of friends and buddies, and then you either just drift away, or sometimes people's lives just take very different turns to yours, and, you know, you kind of end up looking back and kind of and often finding out, like, secondhand, as I have, like, with some friends, where they've gone in very different directions to how you would ever have imagined. And so I think it really puts that feeling across really well of just kind of the progression of time and what it does to people, and how, you know, groups that can be very tight knit become far, far less so over the course of time as kind of life, you know, wears away at them or whatever. And so all of that stuff is really played out very well. And I mean, the thing that kept coming into my head is, like, I could imagine, like, an anime adaptation of this with a Mario Kart screenplay.
Oh, totally.
Because this has a real Mario Kart vibe to it in some really direct ways. I mean, there's a point where kind of Sugi kind of, like, looks around sort of, you know, the town she's moved back to, and sees kind of the mountains around it as like a prison, which is a literal kind of exactly the same thing that A. Mario Kart writes in her autobiography, that she also uses in Anthem of the Heart, as just a kind of, like, you know, this small town surrounded by mountains is, like, basically become a cage. Mm. And, like, I think that's something that kind of, it plays, Sugi is the one that verbalizes it, but all of the characters are kind of suffering from that in their own different ways. They're all kind of imprisoned by their situation and in a place where they can't easily escape it, or at least can't see an escape of it. And then, yeah, like, as mentioned, you know, you have this escape to Tokyo for Sugu and Sora, which, yeah, I'm really interested to see kind of how that progresses and how that pans out, because, yeah, again, there's this very weathering with you kind of feeling, this very idealistic sense that, again, I think everybody at least countenances at some point as a kid or as a teenager, of just like, hey, if I just ran away somewhere, like, all my problems would go away. It would be easy, right? Like, you know, everything would just turn around. And, you know, it just, I'm really fascinated to see where it goes with that, because, you know, clearly that ain't how these things typically work.
No, it has this really fascinating dynamic as well, because, I mean, like, even from the moment they hit the ground, like, Suga's like, right, got to be responsible. I'm the one who talked him into this. And it's like, you know, Sora gets in some guilt, and, you know, fascinating, also really amazing. Like, I was actually really glad of it, of like, okay, they're going to split the group up and let things work out a little. Because, like, what, as you say, like, the town, the hometown they're in is a prison, their own history and lives are a prison. And Sugu coming back kind of throws everyone for a loop, partially because, you know, they get back together and there's obviously something wrong, but also Sugu has become this, like, rather terrifying mirror onto the rest of the cast, especially Alice, I feel, where, you know, she's extremely, like, not really, you know, kind of misplacing her anger, but, like, she's extremely jealous of Sugu and really unhappy with her return in some regards. And it's this sort of thing about, like, Sugu returning has put a mirror up to her about, oh, nothing's changed and that sucks, or, oh, this guy has changed but that sucks. And it's just all this stuff about Sugu coming back and basically laying everyone bare, whereas they'd previously settled into this really uncomfortable but also toxic status quo that was at least an equilibrium. There's at least one moment in this, like, book where I yelled at my tablet because something really quite horrible was about to happen, that you also at the same time could totally understand how the character would be driven to it. And I think you can probably guess at what moment I'm about to talk about, Andy, but I won't say it exactly for spoilers. But there is a moment when it's like, oh, this could be a real terrible, like, moment of no return for most of these cast. And then there is a breaking point where Sugu basically intercedes and goes, hey, what the fuck? And at that point, illusions are broken, everything's kind of ruined, and everyone has to pick up the pieces, or in some cases, basically just walk away from it all. And it's a really fascinating thing. And it's, again, it's one of these thuds where, you know, it's not trying to snap you over the author's knee. It's just another, like, thud on you as you're getting to terms with it. And yeah, as you say, I'm really interested in the weathering with you sort of aspect. Like, I know I keep referencing it, but it is cool about the whole, like, fuck it, let's run away to the city and figure out ourselves and let's go on a weird adventure because God knows.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's really fascinating, but also just, It's also a really fascinating, like, look at these four characters and the world they're in, and, like, how their tiny, small, goddamn town is a nightmare. It almost has shades of Flowers of Evil, except without the jacking it, frankly. Thankfully, I suppose.
Well, yeah. I mean, again, I think, yeah, there's definitely that sort of, it's almost that kind of like corrupting nature of there being nothing to do, nothing for these kids. Mm. And
everyone knows your name, like, and that sucks.
Yeah, for sure. But yeah, I mean, I think that moment that you reference is a particularly powerful one. And it's also like, it's a really good kind of breaking point for the series and for this volume, because in the lead up to that, it's clear that kind of Sugu has kind of reached a place where, even if she's not kind of admitting it to herself, like, she's kind of realized, like, something's up here. In fact, multiple things are up here. Like, things are not what they used to be, and things are not what perhaps everybody was trying to pretend they were upon her return. And she either can't quite put a finger on it, or she can and just doesn't want to. And like, that is the moment that, like you say, it just shatters that illusion completely of just like, this is not the point where I can cover my ears and be like, la la, everything's great. Aren't we such a great bunch of friends? Like, it's the point that literally just smashes everything to the ground and just says like, no, this is broken. This is irreparably broken now. Like, there is no way really back from this moment because of the things that you now know and have seen. And it's also like, I think it does a really good job of, it knows the exact right time to dig into the backstory to fill in the gaps for the reader of kind of what's happening here, because there's definitely a point where it's like, okay, like, there's, you know, there's bullying going on here, there's this whole kind of change in the relationship between characters in this time since Sugu's gone away, like, what has happened here? And it picks just the right time to sit the reader down and be like, okay, like, here's the story, like, here's what happened. And it kind of, all of that stuff is effective, I think, in kind of like building that narrative and building that picture, and not just relying on a kind of hand wavy, like, yep, people change. And it kind of shows that process in a way that is sort of believable, adds a little bit of sympathy to characters who are otherwise unsympathetic, and kind of like really just fills in all the blanks on the cast in a way that really worked for me.
Yeah, totally. I feel like, I know I keep referencing it, but with Alice in particular, like, who is going through some rough old stuff, and lots of feelings churning around, where, like, you know, she ends up basically buying into bullying Sugu, and Sugu, like, kind of gets on the sharp end of it, and, you know, you can kind of see the cogs turning ahead of, like, oh, this is how it's going to be, huh? And, you know, Alice is taken aback by it, but also at the same time can't really stop it at that point. So it's this really rough breaking point where just all these factors have come to converge, and, oh, no, that's broken. That's irreparably changed. And now things continue to move on without, and it doesn't melodrama it up or go, oh, you traitor. It's just like, no, this is how it is. This is how high school is. Shit sucks. I will admit, actually, there was one part of me where for a while I was a bit confused about if they were in junior high or high school for real. Mostly just due to the character designs and trying to figure it out and the gap in time. But eventually they sort of explain that, thankfully. So, which also explains why, you know, running around wielding a guitar. So that's kind of cool. But yeah, it's a really fascinating read on that point.
Yeah, the guitar part in particular, I feel like that all played really well, because it's one of those things where... Sorry?
Good pun. Sorry.
No. Oh, yeah, I didn't even realize I'd made that pun. Good God. But yeah, like, it's because it's one of those things where it kind of... It felt perhaps like it was just going to be one of those things of just like, hey, I want to draw a sweet guitar because that's going to look really cool, like, you know, as kind of cover imagery or kind of like, you know, a big two-page spread or whatever. But like, again, the way it kind of leads with Sugu kind of like, you know, saving or kind of thwarting this suicide attempt and kind of wrecking the guitar in the process. And then you kind of, over the course of that volume, you circle right back around on like what a massive moment that is, because like that guitar is incredibly precious to Sugu for reasons that kind of like, you know, it delves into during that volume. And that becomes a really sort of, it becomes a really sort of symbolic moment of like perhaps the most precious possession that she has, she smashes without any second thought for somebody else.
Yeah. It works on both sides for the pain being experienced.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's a really good moment of like what you initially see and be like, oh, that's just a kind of a cool sort of like interesting image. And then when you, by the time you circle back around to actually kind of see it sort of happen in the moment, like it suddenly becomes this intensely powerful thing as well. And it just like adds this whole extra layer to it in a way that kind of really, I think, because you've seen it once already, and then you get to see it again with the full context of what it means in terms of the characters involved and in terms of, you know, the decisions that they're making in that moment. It just kind of adds this real extra kind of gut punch to you that just really kind of stood out to me.
Yeah, I was really glad that, like, it kind of closes that loop kind of early on, mostly because it by at that point it has done the setup, and then the series is then free to, you know, say, right, we've told you everything we need to get to that point, let's move on. And it's really effective in how it very quickly closes that loop. Also, this book is on the larger side. It's like 230 odd pages, nice long chapters. The best part also is that after they've done the whole like suicide attempt thing, he's like, hey, you got some spare charcoal and some meat? Let's have a weird barbecue on the fucking, let's have the saddest bootlocking barbecue on the riverside we've ever seen in our lives.
Yeah, the really great counterpoint to this series as well is like it knows when to kind of, you know, to lift the spirits and to alleviate things a little bit, because yeah, like this book goes some pretty kind of dark places on a kind of character centric level, but it also knows when to just have. It knows when to kind of like drop a little joke or a little moment to kind of alleviate that. And it is kind of like often a sort of gallows humor, but it really helps in terms of just kind of keeping this from dropping too deep into the mire.
Yeah.
And it also feels like it works for Sugu's character in particular. Cause again, I mean, you kind of get to see, you get some really good scenes with her and sort of her family and sort of extended family that she's kind of, you know, moved back in with. And like they have a really good kind of relationship as a family as well that is very much along the same lines. You can kind of see where she gets it from, because like, you know, is it like her sister and like her mom are just very much kind of like, there's some real kind of gallows humor about like why, you know, her mums will have to move back to her hometown and kind of what's going on with their lives. And it kind of, you can kind of see that filter down into Sugu, especially in that moment of just like, well, you know, we might as well just have a barbecue with this charcoal that you just tried to kill yourself
yeah,
with.
Yeah, you might as well. Yeah, is that all the stuff about Sugu and her family life is really, really well pitched as well. It's like, isn't, you know, it kind of runs the full gamut, and it's really fascinating because it's so well handled and it's so meaningful whenever it comes up. And you know, there's a part where like Sugu's mum basically says, oh, how would you feel if I remarried? And she's like, well, and she kind of just sidesteps the entire thing, which is, it's really fascinating. I mean, she does more than that. It's a really impactful, like almost like three pages, but it has like an entire chapter's worth of meaning in that one exchange, which is really fascinating because you can just see the cogs turning constantly. It's really, really great stuff. And as you say, like it really it really humanizes all the characters with those quiet moments and the, as I say, the saddest barbecue in the world on the riverside. But yeah, but also at the same time, like even for the more bully, you know, like Yusuke, who is an ostensible massive bully, like you can kind of like he is not the prime instigator on that stuff, and he is clearly like he is both being pushed and dragging himself down this really dark path, and you know, some part of him still cares, but he is really pushed into a corner and himself trapped. It's just that perhaps his walls aren't the ring of mountains, they are his own life and his own emotional state, so it's really harsh.
Yeah.
Like that character, although he does some despicable stuff for definite and sure, like you can kind of look at him and go, like there is enough here to humanize him that you're like, ah, there is, like, if you can put a hand into that mire, you can pull him out of it, but you're going to do a lot of damage to yourself in the process and it might not work. So there's a lot there. There's a lot there in that character, and it's a miracle that he is not a complete write-off.
Yeah, and I mean, I think, again, that's why the backstory stuff works so well for kind of giving you that realization that, like, there is way more to this character, and that, yeah, like you say, there's still something there to be redeemed. And that's the thing that's kind of really kept me sitting on my hands, like, desperate to read the remaining volumes, because this doesn't feel like it's just going to be a series of kind of relentless despair and just like, you know, all these people are hopeless and kind of, you know, Sugu's the only one that can, you know, redeem anything at all. Like, there's so much to these characters, and I want to see where they go and where they land up and whether there are happy endings to be had or not. And it feels like, yeah, that there are so many possibilities to that, and that they could all be really fascinating to read. So I'm definitely, I fully suspect by the next time we record one of these, our returning champions will be me reading the rest of this series, because I'm absolutely desperate to devour the remaining volumes.
I already have them downloaded on my tablet. But yeah, it's also like, I know I'm hammering this, so apologies. You know what I'm like, but like the cover image of Sugu holding the guitar, and the entire first chapter is basically a procession of like complete draw drop, two-page spreads, which are super great and I love, and this artist and this author is dope, and I even though I must admit, like, reading her work leaves me in dread because it's really impactful, I would not have it any other way, so hooray. mild nausea inducing dread and fear in a series about emotional horror, but in the most human way, I quickly hasten to add. So yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And yeah, like, I mean, as I've sort of already made that allusion, like, if you're particularly a fan of any of Maria Carter's work, then this is absolutely kind of must read stuff, because it sits in very much the same kind of, space as that. And, you know, if anything, it arguably does it even better than some of Maria Carter's stuff. So, yeah, like, it is absolutely fantastic. So I'm hoping that the remaining volumes can continue in that vein.
Yeah, and I know I say this a lot about sometimes, but like, the fact it's three volumes is nice and tight, so kind of excited to go back to it. If you're interested in this, it's often on sale, which, and also it's three volumes, nice and tight, and so yeah, I wonder if there would be an adaptation of it. That would probably be pretty exhausting. I'd love to see it.
Yeah,
I'd love to see it, but I can already see myself, like, after the screening, like, crying. So I can already feel the tears.
yeah, for sure. And I mean, as a three volume thing, you could almost see it like working as a film as well. Like, I think you could probably make a decent like 2-hour film out of it, depending on what the content of the remaining volumes are. But yeah, who knows? But either way, like, yeah, this is definitely a highly recommended volume.
Oh, for me. that's the one thing as well. Yeah, highly recommended. Really loved it. Will admit, like, I was quite anxious starting reading it, because The God's Lie is very good and loved it, and see previous episode where we talked about it, but also, man alive, did it affect me. So I was kind of coming to this going, oh man, like, a three volume banger by this author is going to be something, and it was.
Yeah, for sure. It also feels like I feel like this is definitely a more sort of mature work that has come on, because it was what, like, this is like what, 5 years after The God's Lie, if I recall. Yep. And it definitely, like, you can definitely see like the craft has improved here, because I mean, you know, I think that The God's Lie, there were definitely things that we could kind of like nitpick and kind of pick apart with it. This feels like it's far kind of more solid, like it's almost kind of like beyond criticism in a certain way, because it really kind of nails everything it's going for and doesn't really fudge any of it.
Yeah, it has a greater degree of self-confidence and self-assurance in it, which really comes through. It's possessed of itself, the work. Is that even a phrase? I don't even know. You know what I mean?
It is now.
Yeah, okay. It has itself, and it knows what to do with it. There we go. Right, God. Anymore, before I say anything more stupid, do we have anything more to say about The Golden Sheep?
No, I think we've both gushed plenty about this.
There is one final thing I want to say about it. You'll see a sign next to said golden sheep which says, please do not climb on the sheep, and you'll in fact find out why there is a sign that says, do not climb on the sheep. That was pretty great. Oh, stupid gags. Anyway, moving on to what we're going to cover next episode. So I've gone back to part of my backlog, and also something that's been kind of a, I should probably get round to reading this title once again. So I've picked Volume 1 of Vinland Saga, which I believe at this point is like omnibus editions digitally and also physically. I know it was released in these big honking hardback volumes, so kind of a lot of pages. So apologies, Andy, but hey, I want to get through this and have a look. So I believe it's also been at least one Humble Bundle, so have a look for that. But how about you?
Cool. Yeah, so I've gone for a rather different tact with this one, and actually I'd kind of completely forgotten that I believe this is also getting an anime
adaptation. Yep, it's in this season.
About to start airing as well. And I've chosen the series, or volume one of the series, With a Dog and a Cat, Every Day is Fun, which I'm also going to have to, I'm going to have to sanity check this with a friend of mine who owns a dog and a cat and insists that not every day is fun, so we shall see how that goes.
Yeah, I feel like there should be quotes around fun and an image of a pooper scooper on the cover. But yeah, anyway, I have a cat and that's quite enough for me. But yeah, that's the this episode closing down now. So if you want to see our other podcasts or previous episodes of the podcast, you can go to screentone.club. You can follow us on Twitter at screentoneclub. You can also email us at show@screentone.club if you would like. We're also on YouTube. Have a little search for Screentone Club. The URL is a mess. I'm not going to read it out because it's complete word salad. You can find me, quick mention, we have a Patreon. If you like this episode and would like to support our work, please go to patreon.com/screentoneclub or one word, and you can support us from the mere sum of $1 a month and get monthly bonus episodes directly from us. And once we, you know, not too much further is the tier where we do two bonus episodes a month, which would be pretty cool. Myself, I'm Elliot Page. You can find me at Elliot Page on Twitter, mostly posting pictures of my cat. So there. And also how bloody cold it's gotten because winter has come to Scotland. Oh God, my southern bones cannot take it. And Andy, how about you?
Yeah, you can find me on Twitter at Hannah's1979, where thankfully I'm well used to the cold Scottish winters at this point, so I'll still complain anyway. What the heck?
Might as well. What else are you going to do? Oh dear. So cool. Thank you very much for listening and good night.
Bye, everyone. Bye.